My name is Brad McKay. I'm the director of the Doug Wright Awards, which is a nonprofit organization that recognizes the best Canadian comic novels and comics, past and present. But before I begin, I'd just like to introduce you to your nominee for the 2010 Doug Wright Awards. Adam Bray.
Yeah.
Chester Brown and Sean Rogers. And then we also have a jury process, and that involved this year Carl Wilson, who's a writer and editor for the Globe and Mail, Jeff Bevere, who is a books critic and a writer for book critic for the Star and a writer in his own right, Fiona Smythe, who's an artist and cartoonist, and Matt Forsythe, who's a cartoonist and illustrator. So I'll just run through the awards. We have the Pigskin Peters Award, which is right here, and right there. Which recognizes the best in non-narrative or avant-garde comics. It's named after a popular character in the seminal Canadian comic strip Bird's Eye Center by Canadian cartoonist Jimmy Fries. And the award is a bit of a tip of the hat to non-traditional work that may be non-narrative or unique but still deserves recognition. And the awards obviously reflect this because it is actually a hat, a bowler hat, which makes King Peter himself wore. And it also comes with a plaque that doubles as a hook to hang it on. was my idea. second is the Best Emerging Talent Award, which recognizes the best in new and developing talent, kind of mid-career talent. And the winners of both of these, both this category and the Best Book category, get this beautiful Doug Wright Award. We also have a Giants of the North Hall of Fame Award, which is called, subtitled, Our Canadian Cartoonist Hall of Fame. And this year we're happy to have Kate Beaton present our last year's Best Emerging Talent on hand to help induct Martin Vaughn James into the Hall of Fame. And at the end of the evening, the last act will be the Best Book Award, which recognizes the best single work graphic novel from 2009. And somebody reminded me to say this, because this happens sometimes to the winners. If you win, when you hear your name, just stay seated, because we will have jury members come up and deliver an appreciation book on behalf of the jury for you. So stay seated until somebody calls you. as well, I should note that each of the winners of each of the awards will receive a special, can we show it to you? But a special bound copy of your book that we prepared for you. It's kind of like a library version. And I should say as well, for the sake of Peter, the following ceremony, all three winners of the awards will be at the back of the room, signing copies of their book. Did the nominees know that? I don't think so. I hope you're allowed to pens. So I'm going to pass the show off to Peter Udrich, the actor, rock hunter, comics fan. And that's it.
Thank you, Brad. It's really great to be here tonight. First off, I'd like to say the only reason I'm so horribly overdressed is because Seth drew me in a tuxedo on the invitation. So I just naturally assumed it was a black tie affair. The creepy thing about it was that he actually drew my tuxedo. And he's never seen my tuxedo before. Anyway, I'm very, very excited to be here. When Jerry Chikaridi asked if I would host the awards this year, I jumped at the chance, not just because, you know, when Jerry says do something, I do it, but I've been a comic books fan for my entire life, and that's no word of a lie. When I was in grade two, all I wanted to do was draw pictures, and I had a very clever teacher who realized that the only way she was going to get me to learn how to read and write was by stapling a whole bunch of construction paper together and putting a big pile of these books on my desk and saying, here's the deal, you can draw all you want, but on one page you need to draw the picture, on the other page you need to write what the picture is about. And over the course of grade two, so I must have been about 7 or 8, I drew about 100 comics. And when I turned 40, my 40th birthday, my mom surprised me with a nice big parcel of all 100 of those comics that I drew when I was 8 years old. Nice big bow. And I just to let you know that I'm not lying about this, I went through them and I've got a selected few titles, only the best ones. I'm only going to read you the titles because the content is far too graphic. So right off the top, it's a no-brainer. G.I. Joe. by Peter. This is the original 12-inch G.I. Joe with the lifelike hair and the kung fu grip, by the way. Not the dinky 5-inch plastic versions. A G.I. Joe book. The Secret Treasure Chest. By Peter. This is where I realized that sometimes it was important to tell what the content of the adventure was going to be, not just the title of the main character. It's a very seminal time in my work. The Green Hornet and Spider-Man. I believe this is the first Marvel DC crossover comic. It was a goodie. The Mysterious Cave and Spider-Man. My titles were starting to get a little out of control at this point. The Two Old Men Who Helped a Whale and Called Him Namu. This was a co-effort. This was between my friend Graham and I. I think he did the ink. And finally, this was a return to my earlier work. This one's simply called The Races. Would like to read this to you. This was an important work to me. I actually wrote my whole name on this one, Peter Outerbridge. So I really thought I'd matured. The races had come. And you see there's a car here, flames coming out of the back. The cars got lined up and... Wait for it. There was a big hill. I almost fell off. See, he's going so fast up that I drew backwards because I hadn't quite figured that out. But he's going so fast that he actually pops a wheelie and actually almost falls off. Gets better. Here we go. There was a big crash. Two cars crashed, and it was a big crash. Crash! And, of course, that's the crash, and it was very graphic, actually. There's a wheel going up, there's an ambulance over here. It's bad. Oh, yeah. There was a big jump over one of the cars, hit a car, and crashed! It was a recurring theme in the story. Oh, yeah, this is like sort of a slight pause in the story. The car had a flat. Because, you know, you need to bring the story down before you bring it back up, which is what happens now, because there was a big rocket in the race. Because why not, really? And, of course, I was heavily influenced by Speed Racer because this car has plenty of accoutrements that it can pop out to defeat the rocket. So don't worry about that guy. They race to the finish line to win the races and get the trophy, which was a pretty obvious statement, but I just threw it in there. Oh, yeah, a car went so fast that it went on fire. Like, it doesn't get more exciting than this. Come on. This guy's, he's jumping out. He's jumping out of the car to avoid being burned. One of the drivers got shot. Come on. I had crossed the finish line. There I am. I'm dreaming of the trophy. There's the trophy. I'm dreaming about it. I love drawing the bubbles. And I won the race. Look, I won the race and clearly got a much buffer for it. Just avoiding all those rockets, clearly. And there's the award. And my favorite part of the book, which was very telling of my teacher, actually. And you know what? She only ever wrote this in this one comic. The end. Very nice. Thank you, Peter. Very nice. It's a sign of my props back in the day. completely unsolicited. My 6-year-old son, Tom, he comes running home from senior kindergarten and quite excitedly says, "Dad, I drew a comic. Can I show it to you?" So very quickly, he told me this story. I won't bore you with it. It's very amateur. Guys fighting, and there's the tanks, and then they get into more tanks, more fighting. And I think that's Darth Maul, I'm not sure. But then there's this thing over here. That's a Bionicle. I know that part. And then they climb up a mountain. There was a lava thing. He had to draw it that way. But, that's common these days. And then they're in a graveyard. Those are tombstones. And they were fighting ghosts, which is amazing to me, because I don't know how you do that. Then everything gets really out of control. I don't really follow the story at this point. It's just sort of mayhem and chaos. But anyway. But then they just built this amazing thing, and everybody lived happily ever after. So, what do you know? We just passed the torch. As excited as I was to be here tonight and sort of be a part of all of you guys in this whole event, it was amazing to me how difficult it was to get some of the nominees to actually attend this ceremony. And it's kind of hard to explain. We actually, I believe we made a video about how difficult this was to get people to come. Why don't we just run the video? It's pretty self-explanatory.
On the surface, George seems a charming, foolish old man. But who is he? And who was he? George Sprott is a story about time, identity, loss, and the pervasiveness of memory. Hey, George, I'm Pete Outerbridge, the host of the Doug Wright Awards. Check your mail for an invitation.
Oh, drifting. Should get to that mail.
George, read the invitation. George, you've been nominated for a Doug Wright Award.
Odd dream. Isn't that Peter Outerbridge handsome?
Back and Forth is a novel in 90 line of cuts. It examines what it means to belong, to assimilate, to be distant, and to challenge the constraints of time and space.
Hi, it's Pete Outerbridge here. Is this the girl from Back and Forth? I'm not sure of your name, since there aren't any words in your book. I'm not really sure what you're saying. Look, I want to invite you to Toronto to the Doug Wright Awards. You've been nominated. I hope you're saying that you can make it.
Peter Outerbridge sounds dreamy.
Red documents the powerful story of a leader blinded by revenge. When the pages of this Haida manga are arranged in a specific order, the panels of the narrative create a Haida formline image.
Please be careful, Peter. Red doesn't like award shows.
But this award is different. It's very prestigious. Red? Are you there? Come out. You've been nominated for a Doug Wright Award. Huh? What is it, sir? I don't know. Something's following us. To the beach, now!
Stay away, Peter. I don't care how handsome you are.
Please reconsider.
Part art monograph, part comics collection. Hot Potato seamlessly combines decade-plus comics activities with a lifelong devotion to, as author Mark Bell calls it, fine artworks.
And these layers of the earth did rise and did drink unto themselves from the soda pop.
Introducing Guston.
Augustine built his home there, in the curve of that layer of the earth there.
Inside!
I ought to get one of those doohickeys that only allow outgoing calls. Hello and good evening, caller.
Hi, Augustine. Pete Outerbridge here. You're invited to Ontario for the Doug Wright Awards. I'll send some of those bug things to bring you.
And those bug things carried Gustin through the air. And Gustin fell asleep as they crossed the Ontario border. And Gustin dreamed of meeting Peter Outerbridge.
Allegedly raised in a dark cellar and deprived of human contact until the age of 16, Caspar tells the strange story of Caspar Hauser.
The cellar I have always lived in is about 6 feet long and 4 feet wide. I have a wooden horse. When I wake up, there is a piece of bread at my side and a little jug of water. It never occurs to me to want to stand up. One day, a man in black with beautiful golden hair.
I have to take you to Toronto.
Peter takes my two arms and puts them around his neck. He smells really good. I start to cry because I'm so happy for being nominated. And because the handsomest man in the world is now my friend. Because he has stopped keeping me in his cellar. Congratulations to all the nominees.
That was very good.
For the 2010 Pigskin Peters Award are Babette, Salmon Bossa. Published by Loin de Crevin, Babette, roughly translated as The Bug, is a dark collection of gag comics set in a bizarro universe of cannibalism, domestic tragedy, and romantic failure. With unassuming animals standing in for humans, Bossa, a veteran of the Quebec alt comic scene, takes the idea of anthropomorphic comics to its absurd extreme, filtering the vision of Daumier and Granville through a punkish, prankish, art brute version of the comic strip. Try and picture Blondie and Dagwood depicted as a family of caviar-munching sturgeon, and you'll get a rough idea of what he's pulled off here. Featuring bold brush lines and sly humor, Bossé's wordless strips take a tradition as old as comics themselves, funny animals, and turns them into an existential punchline. The result is acerbic, creepy, disarming, and funny as hell. Dirty Dishes, Amy Lockhart, published by Drawn and Quarterly. Amy Lockhart's people, depicted in acrylic pencil, cross stitch, and sculpture, all share something in common. They are desperately off in some way. Cartoonified, infantilized, sometimes downright unearthly, their anatomies are wrenched out of whack, their limbs lopped off, their torsos contorted beyond recognition, their faces molded and pulled and mashed in like putty. But do they care? Which seems to be fine with them. In fact, they almost dare you to have a problem with it. This is how they are, and you've just got to deal with it. In Dirty Dishes, the portraits of quote-unquote ladies, as Lockhart calls them, are brazenly, confidently unladylike. These ladies defy convention at every turn, wrestling and smoking, wreaking havoc with whatever norms of representation we might expect to encounter in typical portraiture. There's a blithe challenge in the way they leer out from the page or the canvas, conspiratorial camaraderie that we only catch glimpses of when they braid each other's hair or hunt down dirty dishes to lick them clean. Don't chase after dirty dishes, says Quebec's spot-on mascot in one strip. Walk for walk is his weird advice to the two determined ladies who are passing by. Yeah, sure, but I'm whatever. See ya, chow, they say. Lockhart's ladies may walk or run or pose or strut or glare, but they'll do whatever they damn well please, and Dirty Dishes is testament to the fact. Hot Potato, Mark Bell, published by Drawn and Quarterly.
Seamlessly combining a decade's worth of comics activities with a lifelong devotion to fine artworks, as Bell calls them. Hot Potato is a massive testament to one of Canada's most iconoclastic talents. Part art monograph, part comics collection, Hot Potato is filled with mixed media cardboard constructions, watercolor drawings, altered found texts, and Bell's most intense, dizzying comics from contemporary avant-garde comics anthologies. Bell's works have their roots in draftsmanship, typography, and old-fashioned gags, but morph into assemblages that connect his images into real space. His comics are funny, seat-of-the-pants narratives that give his characters an inner life. Armed with a barnstorming repeatograph, London, Ontario's Bell comes across like the gonzo stepchild of Philip Guston, R. Crumb, and Basquiat. This is the second time he has been nominated for a Doug Wright Award. Never learn anything from history. Kate Beaton. Kate Beaton is like the charming party crasher you never want to go home. Sneaking up on the comics world via her hep comic, Hark a Vagrant, Beaton is a talent to be reckoned with, and a refreshing throwback to the history-based satire that was a mainstay of 1960s Canadian comics from the likes of Peter Whaley and George Fair. With a pen in one hand and an English degree in the other, Beaton is unafraid to commingle clever comedy with her itinerant literary interests. In Never Learn Anything from History, no one escapes her witty barrage, whether it's George Orwell and Oscar Wilde to Friedrich Nietzsche, Genghis Khan, and Louis Riel. If you have a beloved historical or literary figure, chances are she's tackled them in her strip. Few other strip collections stand up so well to repeated readings. If you own this book, you already have a favorite or two. Whether it's Pope Action Comics, Yeats in Love, or another deranged Garfield cartoon. Like a shot out of the blue, Kate Beaton is quickly becoming a Canadian cartooning institution. This is Beaton's second Doug Wright Award nomination. She won the Best Emerging Talent Award in 2009. The Collected Doug Wright, Canada's Master Cartoonist, by Doug Wright. Published by Drawn and Quarterly. For too long, Doug Wright seemed to be at risk of fading into the cultural horizon, more a vague memory than a cartoonist who deserved, even demanded, to be read. This lavish volume, stunningly designed and edited by Seth, was a game-changer for Wright. It gave the legendary Canadian cartoonist the platform that many believed he has long deserved. Among the many visual delights in the massive book, the highlight has to be the 150 pages devoted to his flagship title, Nipper, which is the perfect showcase for Doug Wright's master draftsman skills and his keen eye for the nuances of childhood and family life. Add to this Brad Mackay's biographical essay on Wright, by far the most in-depth and sensitive biography ever recorded to a Canadian cartoonist, and the end result is an instant classic. This book is already one of the foundational volumes for Canadian cartooning. And the winner is Hot Potato. In the house.
Prods you. in Hot Potato, even when he's not doing comics in the traditional sense of the word, he's still telling stories through his illustrations and sculptures that fold in on themselves and regurgitate pop culture into the Tim Hortons cup of the subconscious. Hot Potato is a collection of work that is insulting and hilarious and sarcastic and sincere, and the art is done with a consistency and a confidence that many of us aspire to. This stuff has influenced a whole wave of comics and artists, myself included, and I continue to be inspired by his audacity. Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Bell.
Disarmingly frank book, Bure's clean, straightforward art exfoliates so that his inner life of imaginary friends is given form and shape unto itself. Though still young, Bure is smart enough not to let his narrative get bogged down by his dark material. I'm Crazy is leavened by wit and affection for friends and family and belongs to the distinguished tradition of autobiographical cartoonists such as Justin Green and Chester Brown. Michael DeForge, or Lou, Loss Number One, published by Koyama Press. Michael DeForge's Loss is a hyperactive pinball machine of a comic that is perpetually on the brink of tilting into the absurd. Most of its pages are devoted to the journey of a cute doodle named Nesbitt, who gets banished to a cartoon hell for being a cruddy excuse for a guardian elf. From there, DeForge careens narratively and thematically, unleashing his creativity on the page with irrepressible inky abandon. Just 22 years old, this Toronto cartoonist has clearly soaked up a wild range of cartooning history, including newspaper strips, underground comics, alternative comics, Saturday morning cartoons, EC horror comics, even the Justice League of America. The superhero elements strike just the right notes of petty bragging, unhinged machismo, and teenage angst, with a Batman, drunk on malt liquor, haranguing Green Lantern and propositioning Hawkgirl. Meanwhile, his horror moments, which feature monsters, bloodletting, and sacrilegious rites, are actually genuinely disturbing. Not to be overlooked, his sweaty, boozy, autobiographical pages achieve the perfect mix of self-pitying and self-lacerating. Loss number one is an honest-to-God, no-holds-barred comic book in an age ruled by the graphic novel. It deserves to be rolled up and jammed into some kid's back pocket. It should be sold to head shops and read slowly beneath the dorm room blacklight. It should enrage authority figures, confuse parents, and delight anyone who, like DeForge, knows how awesome and poignant and anxious comics can be. Pascal Gerard, Nicola, published by Drawn and Quarterly. There are not many debut graphic novels that are capable or confident enough to impart a profound emotional response from a reader. This is exactly what Pascal Gerard has done with Nicola, short but moving autobiographical tale of the lingering effects of the death of his younger brother. Using a spare, wavering line, ghostly backgrounds, and a few well-chosen words, Gerard conjures up the remaining memories of their shared childhood and artfully conveys the absence he still feels years after the fact. Constructed as a series of vignettes from before and after his brother's death, the cartoonist treats his subject matter with a spare line and a refreshingly matter-of-fact tone that avoids sentimentality and proves to be all the more moving as a result. Nicola is an elegant meditation on mourning and lost innocence that reveals Pascal Gerard, already a star in his own right within his native Quebec, as a talent to watch in the rest of the country. John Martz, It's Snowing Outside. We should go for a walk. This sleek, sublime 12-page mini-comic from Ottawa's John Martz punches well above its weight class. Lovingly produced in grays and blue, this winter walk story with a twist takes a funny anecdote and transforms it into a sweet, dark, super short story. While quantity and page count is a common yardstick for quality in comics, Martz, a talented cartoonist and popular illustrator, manages to pack more naturalism into his small book than many cartoonists do in their entire career. Always a talent to watch, Martz was nominated in the Pigskin Peters Awards in 2008. This book is the mere tip of the iceberg, and what will surely be a productive and promising career in comics for Martz. Sully, the Hipless Boy, published by Conundrum Press. Sully, a.k.a. Sherwin Teja, has been laboring in the outer boroughs of the Montreal comic scenes for years now, creating art of an arch and meticulous nature. The Hipless Boy collects the series of strips begun for the McGill Daily about city life among the young, the hip, and the not-so-hip. The book, chock-a-block as it is with nighttime prowls, chance encounters, experiments in transvestism, heartbreak, and art world hijinks, exposes Sully's talent for whimsy, poetry, a tightly controlled fluid line, and very nicely spotted blacks. Anyone who spent any time in Montreal will notice it as a main character in the book. Sully has nailed the look and feel of the city wonderfully, from the Cinéma L'Amour, Cinéma du Parc, Cagibi, and Chez José. This is Sully's first Doug Wright Award nomination. The envelope, please.
Emerging Talent Award is Michael DeForge.
And I want to say what a pleasure it's been to serve on the jury and kind of get to a little pass into the comics community, a place that I don't normally reside, and it's been a real pleasure. Consider, if you dare, what lies inside the mind of a cartoonist. Somewhere in there, alongside the neuroses, the heavy postules of envy, the gnawing buzzsaw sound of unadmitted ambition, lies a vast archive of every drawn image, every curving line and hatch shading that's ever been sucked into her or his visual cortex. And elsewhere, burbling in some primordial stew of auditory memories, are every line of dialogue heard from Saturday morning cartoons up to the latest YouTube clip. How does the cartoonist distinguish their own ideas from amid the stuffed creaking doors of culture and trash? The cover of Michael DeForge's Lose Number 1 depicts this dilemma in gruesome detail, the artist's own head churning with comic strip explosions and bam sound effects, his brow burdened with silhouettes of the images found inside. And in the course of the fractured but coherent narrative in the comic, he commits ritual suicide, travels to a hell where Golinkle the Moose sits in a bar full of condemned characters, Dick Tracy vomiting into his hat, and watches his own happiest memories of his days with Rocky rerun over and over on TV until, as Bullwinkle puts it, your smile burned in every frame will begin to appear ridiculous and unnatural, nothing more than a crude carving on a marionette's face. The bar sits in a building on top of a mountain in the shape of the head of Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy. DeForge is met there by the elf, previously mentioned, Nesbitt Lemon, who's failed miserably at his It's a Wonderful Lifestyle duty to show DeForge that life is worth living. Yet all this nihilism and parody is relieved by gentle, quiet moments, cinematic film noir transitions, and a sense of sure-handed craftsman's control over his medium. And if that's not enough for you, take a break with Green Lantern's creative block in art school, or the one-panel humor of dogs in college, skipping class because they can read the notes later in the professor's urine, or debating earnestly whether it's racist to be attracted only to terriers. John Mayer, check it out. Still in his early 20s, DeForge is a talent confident enough to undermine his own mastery, subverting the cleanness of his lines with separating, sweating curlicues over every surface, and to swallow up and render parasitic the history of his medium, reborn both new and broken, fresh-faced and diseased. And he grants it a mythic dimension that makes it far more than an inside joke. Instead, it finds a context where everyone in North America, people all over the world, are full to the point of nausea with received culture, the state of the 21st century human condition. His work revels in this state even as it questions it, fearless of what idea belongs to whom. And paradoxically enough, that makes it as individual as it could be under the circumstances. With the second issue out already, a very different, more slowly paced coming of age or perhaps growing up gross story, we're seeing in DeForge's Lose the beginning of what might be the comic world's next Eightball or Yummyverse. And so we couldn't be more delighted to grant Michael DeForge this year's Doug Wright Award for Best Emerging Artist.
My opinion and feelings on the whole institution. So I'm going to begin. I have a story for you. In the early 20th century, Stephen Leacock was more famous than anyone in Canada, maybe the most well-known humorist in North America. Robert Benchley and Groucho Marx were fans. Countless humorists at the time said him as an influence. And that's not an inconsiderable feat. And it's, you know, 100 years later, most Americans, even among humorists, have no idea who he is. But we all know the Marx Brothers and the writers of the Algonquin Roundtable. And why should that be? What I've always thought was that in an anthology of 20th century humor, it's just that easy to leave him out. When reprinting volumes, it's easy for an American publisher to pass him by for not being an American. It's Canadian literature, that's where it should come from, and that's true. So, yeah, Americans, they don't know who Stephen Leacock is, but Canadians do. Every year here, we have the Leacock Medal for Humor. I don't even know what edition Sunshine Sketches of a Small Town, a little town it is on, but, you know, it's up there. I remember a passage of it being in a high school textbook of mine, and, you know, you see it in bookstores. It's around. Leacock was one of our greatest humorists, and we take pride in it. Cartoonists in this country have received very little of this in comparison. So I have another story for you. I'm going to begin by telling you what I do. I make comments about history, and Canadian history is prominently included in that. And in 1984, Peter Whaley published a book called Great Moments in Canadian History. It's very funny, it's well done. It was only published 1 year after I was born, and by one of the best this country has ever produced. You'd think that I'd have heard of it before last year, giving our similar interests, its high profile, the fact that everyone likes to compare, but you'd be wrong. I found it by chance on a library shelf. And I say by chance because it happened to be there, not that I was just fumbling around the library. I was looking for something. I was looking, but I didn't know what I was looking for, because over the years, not much has really rolled up on my doorstep concerning cartoonists in my country. It's hard to find. You have to go hunting for it. For any talented artist to be forgotten is a sad thing. For it to happen, or to let it happen to our greatest, I think is a shame. Whaley, I don't know if it's Whaley or Whaley, actually, when I Googled his name later on, one of the first things that came up was the Doug Wright Awards, because he is part of the Hall of Fame, and one of the giants of the North. When I read that, I felt that little pang of embarrassment that you get when you just read something that should be obvious to you. And it goes, of course, he's good. Of course, you should have known he's in the Hall of Fame. And yet, when people make comparisons to my work, I never get Whaley. I get... when people look at my work, they say Quentin Blake, they say Sheldon Silverstein, they say any number of names, but never a Canadian. And I think that we take geographical boundaries for granted in an age of such advanced communication, but I also think that they still matter a lot. They're very important. And what I like about the Doug Wright Awards is that they offer to correct the oversights of the past, because even if a cartoonist's work stands the test of time, it's not necessarily their job to make us to make it stay there. It's ours. For those of us who have been nominees and winners, the Doug Wright Awards make the smallest, nicest gesture, which is just recognition. I'm happy to have been a winner last year. I'm glad to see the awards mentioned when I'm profiled in an interview or in a publication. It's a little nod. It's something that stays put, even if my comments are one day only on a shelf in a library by chance. And with that, I have the pleasure of talking about our newest giant of the North, Martin Vaughn James. Last summer, saw the passing of a painter, a novelist, an illustrator, cartoonist, Martin Vaughn James. He might have distanced himself from that last handle, cartoonist, maintaining that his works were new, although that they hovered around the traditional comic book, they never fully landed within that field. While Vaughn James might have asked us to understand his small shelves worth of books as visual narratives or visual novels or even ones of movie, he nevertheless worked tirelessly. To challenge and contribute to the language of comics, what we've come to think of as the graphic novel has endless claimants to the title of inventor, but Vaughn James's role as forefather is distinguished by the unparalleled ambition, ability, and merit of his works like his 1975 masterpiece, The Cage. If The Cage were published today, there would be no question where it would belong. It would be in the graphic novel section. But when Vaughn James was doing his work, there were not graphic novel sections anywhere. The term itself was booted around by a few obscure comic book fans, but wasn't in wide currency. Like a handful of other artists, Vaughn James was a crucial pioneer in creating artistically ambitious comic narratives during a period when there wasn't really an audience or a critical community to appreciate the work. Stuck on the original when they were first done, Vaughn James' visual novels remain a source of inspiration for artists and a high watermark in Canadian comics. Vaughn James was an international artist. His globe-spanning life took him from his home in Bristol, England, to Sydney, Australia, where he studied art, to Toronto, where he did his major experiments in comic form, to Paris and Brussels, where he did his memory-haunted paintings. And despite his wide travels, we in Canada have the right to claim an important part of Vaughn James' patrimony. It was in Toronto that Vaughn James did his visual novels, his working closely with Coach House Press, arguably the most important Canadian literary press in a pivotal moment in our national history. It was Coach House that was the press of Margaret Atwood, Michael Ondaatje, as well as the press where poet-cartoonist B.P. Nichols conducted his own experiments with literary comics. Working with Coach House put Vaughn James in the thick of Canadian literary, in the thick of Canadian literary and artistic culture, and secured him a place in our history. Martin Howard Vaughn James was born December 5th, 1943, in Bristol, England, during an air raid, according to the tongue-in-cheek bio of his first novel, The Detective Satire Night Train, in 1989. After childhood spent in bombed-out post-war towns like Birmingham, being exposed to the residue of destruction that would inform so much of the literary imagination in his work, he immigrated with his family to Australia in 1958, necessitating a six-week voyage by ship, followed by 3 years spent in a migrant camp. He enrolled in the National Art School in Sydney, where he won a painting prize that encouraged him and his lifelong partner, poet Sarah McCoy, to leave the country. He ended up in Toronto in 1968, where he began to consider how he might derange the conventions of comics, allowing the image and text to combine and diverge in perplexing, disarming manners, eventually producing hundreds and hundreds of pages of rigorous, demanding visual narratives. During this outburst of creativity, Vaughn James worked on the imposing full-length books The Projector in 1971, The Cage and Long Couture in 1984, in addition to a series of impressive shorter pieces where he tested out his approach to longer projects. These included chapbooks Elephant in 1970 and The Park in 1972, as well as over a dozen short stories published beginning in 1973 and collected alongside of some of his elaborately detailed drawings in 1982 under the title Après la bataille, excuse my French, it's after the battle. Vaughn James eventually settled in Paris and then in Brussels following his departure from Toronto in 1977. The bulk of his short strips, however, and a good deal of the work on Le Couture had already been completed by the time he left Canada and had made up a part of Vaughn James's solo exhibition in the Art Gallery of Ontario in 1975. It was in Toronto that Vaughn James made the first of his important alliances with the first historic publishing houses when Coach House Press released his second book, The Projector. Coach House had emerged as a major player in burgeoning literary vanguard of Canada at the time, and was home to kindred spirits engaged in radical projects not unlike Vaughn James's. The poets B.P. Nichols and Steve McCaffrey, for instance, were also experimenting with and theorizing about comics form, praising and anthologizing Vaughn James's work. Following The Projector, Coach House published The Park and The Cage as similarly handsome artist books, granting them context and seriousness far removed from the brand of pulpy ephemera that most comics were at the time understood to be. But if Coach House provided Vaughn James with a venue in which we could realize his ideas, the very substance of narrative today could be the destruction within... The very substance of narrative today should be the destruction from within of the worn-out sign language of our culture, he wrote in The Cage. Then it was another seminal publisher that helped him give the inspiration for those ideas. While working in The Cage in Paris in 1972, 1973, Vaughn James became involved with the innovative French firm Édition de Minuit in the publisher's eponymous House Revenue, Review. Vaughn James published strips alongside texts by Samuel Beckett, essays by theorist Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, scenarios by Alain Robbe Grillet. a heady crowd, to say the least. Also appearing in Minuit were an interview with Hergé and early writings by comics critics authors Benoit Peters, who would later make a film about Vaughn James and have the artist star in one of the volumes of his Les Cités Obscures series. Vaudreuil's work would be heavily influenced in particular by the predictions of the Nouveau Roman, who published with Minuit, Rob Grier, Claude Simon, Robert Pinget, whose novels strip the narrative of old conventions and character, plot, and chronology, often in favor of Choisy's aim, a focus on how we perceive objects and how we grant them significance. Reconfiguring narrative in terms of the interplay of things or the simple progression of through time and space makes Vaughan James' work abstract and difficult to summarize, even when characters do appear there are marvels of instability. The earlier works are primarily people by fairly conventional figures, a bald spectacle standing for the author, a bunch of mean-spirited, funny animals, but even so, they metamorphose. They disappear, they turn inexplicably into empty suits of clothes without forewarning. The creator thrusts them through the surreal cityscapes that comment obliquely on the media saturation of the factory farm nature of a contemporary workplace. The kind of emphasis on setting displaces character entirely in Vaudreuil's middle work, but when the human figure reappears in La Couture, it's still the landscapes and the buildings that dominate. One of two characters, here, one, the investigator, never appear in the same way twice. The other, the subject of his investigation, variously called Thompson, Tompkins, Thomason, Thomason, never appears at all. Our attention instead is drawn to the locations through which these ciphers pursue and evade one another, as well as their guns, their raincoats, their fedoras, their valises. The works that preceded La Couture, though, were what truly signaled a sea change in Vaughan James's approach. In the park, nothing but the barest trace of humankind is given any frame. A photo appears, some scissors, a shirt, a skyscraper, all in various stages of decrepitude. The confused and halting narration no longer seems to be anchored on the images, preoccupied with things that never appear before us, like a spots, a watch, a ribbon. The cage recapitulates and perfects all these concerns. In that book, Vaughan James guides a disembodied spectator reader to the desolate landscapes, street scenes, wildernesses, to investigate what happens in the hallway, a room, and in the titular cage. The divorce between the frozen image and the frozen text, that's where the poetic text, the tension on the page between those, I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, the tension on the page between stable space and advancing time, the array of objects put into play, a menacing inky stain, twisted and victimized bed sheets, all become motifs that interact in complex labyrinthine patterns. In doing so, Vaughan James masterfully complicates and then disrupts what we understand the typical functioning comics or narrative or any structure we rely on to make sense of the word. He reveals them to be, like any object from the cage, less an actual machine than an odd and enigmatic abstraction, totally unnatural, its utility obscured. Aside from French comic books collecting sequences that have been developing since the 1970s, and a final nominally narrative collection of his drawings and text in 2007, Vaughan James largely parted ways with comics following his return to Europe. For the last 25 years of his life, he devoted himself to painting haunted canvases that depict ghostly, desiccated images of buildings, objects, and people on the verge of being lost to memory. The induction of Vaughan James into the Giants of the North this year helps to ensure that his work, on the contrary, will continue to live in the memory of us for years to come.
Now, if I could call upon Jeet here to say a few words of acceptance on behalf of Sarah Gordon, Martin Vaughan James Widow.
Martin Vaughan James, as Kate mentioned in her discussion of him, lived in Toronto in the 70s and was very much a part of the sort of arts and cultural scene of the time. And throughout his life, he lived with the poet Sarah McCoy, who was a very important figure in his life, obviously, as his wife, but also an artistic inspiration and muse. She lives in Brussels now, and we informed her that we're going to induct Martin Vaughan James into the Giants of the North. She sent a very heartfelt letter, which I will now read for you. Martin Vaughan James, artist, singer, writer, and first-rate draftsman, inventor of the visual novel, which took place in Toronto, died nearly 10 months ago. It was July 3rd. He was only 65, the most horrible and saddest day of my life. But as Garcia Lorca writes in one of his most beautiful poems, death always comes at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was for me. Martin and I lived together for over 46 and a half years. We were married for 42 years. It was a very deep and strong commitment. He was also my best friend during all those decades, and he taught me a great deal. This reminds me of Faulkner and his friend Phil Stone, the only lawyer in the small town of Oxford, Mississippi. Faulkner dedicated one of his last novels to him with these words: "He did half the laughing for 30 years. John Donne wrote in one of his love poems, "I run to death, and death meets me as fast, and all my pleasures are like yesterday." Martin loved this, and for years we both recited this poem aloud, together like a mantra. It was in Toronto where we lived for 8 years, and with Stan Bevington at Cochas Press, that Martin came into his own. We were all very young and positive. Victor Coleman, who took a photograph of Martin with an old projector at his house on a lovely island long before the tower was built. David Young and Rick Simon, who created alchemy with the images. Rick Simon performed miracles on the drawings in the darkroom, and it was hot as hell in there. All of these figures from Cochas Press were good friends to both of us. The Cage could never have been conceived nor executed without the superb books and color posters that Stan produced. Stan used to say, "Take as many as you want." Martin was gravely ill before he died, and died in Provence, 1,000 kilometers away from me. This is a simple two-line haiku that I wrote for Martin. "He who gave me wings to soar took away the sun." Towards the end of his life, Jack Kerouac was interviewed in St. Petersburg, Florida, and he was asked, "What do you want for the future?" He replied immediately, instantly, "To be safe in heaven, dead." The projector for which, or by inspiration from which, Michael Ondaatje wrote a marvelous poem of the horse falling, I thank Michael Ondaatje now. The Park, The Cage, completely a new kind of book, were accepted by Stan Bevington without hesitation, a true friend, a visionary. In 1975, there was a big exhibition at the Art Gallery of Ontario, Toronto, of Martin's work, Image, Word, Sequence. All his notebooks, etc., were in glass cases. And it was such a hit with the public that it was prolonged for a month or 6 weeks. Later, Anansi Press published several very splendid works of his in their reviews. They, too, have my thanks and praise. Martin had lovely letters from Margaret Atwood and her colleagues, and every Christmas a card. I know that Martin's spirit, his intelligence, his humanity, his creativity, and his insatiable curiosity are still with me. He was an atheist his entire life, but I trust now he is with all his heroes. His death, to me, is tragic and so premature. I loved him my whole adult life, and now I must learn to live alone for the rest of my days. I shall do so for you, Martin. And it's on behalf of Sarah McCoy that we'll accept the award and send it to her.
And now the finalists for the 2010 Doug Wright Award for Best Book are Back and Forth by Marta Hudalinska, published by The Porcupine's Quill. Marta Hudalinska's Back and Forth reinvents and reinvigorates the format of the linocut or woodcut novel for our contemporary rootless society. Following in the footsteps of past practitioners of the art like Lynn Ward and Canada's own Lawrence Hyde, Hudalinska's images of peripatetic shuffling across Canada, a dreamlike dialogue between past and present, east and west. Back and Forth is a stealthy, silent debut novel that pushes the boundaries of our comics universe. George Sprott, 1894 to 1975, by Seth, published by Drawn and Quarterly. Encased in a lovely Art Deco cover,
in his latest graphic novel, Guelph, Ontario cartoonist Seth explores the mystery of George Sprott. His titular Arctic explorer, lecturer, television personality, wayward husband, absent father, and loving uncle. Borrowing techniques of documentary filmmaking, Seth gives us a rounded picture of Sprott, showing him at his charming best and caddish worst. Alternatively witty and melancholy, this graphic novel not only tells the story of a man's life, but also places it against a uniquely Canadian background of the imaginary town of Dominion, giving us a sense of the psychic geography of small-town Ontario by making buildings part of the bouncy... by making buildings part of the... Brad? Story. Hot potato. By Mark Bell. Published by Dronic Quarterly. Bouncy 1930s animation, nightmares, Zap comics, maps, cutaways of the USS Enterprise and the Fortress of Solitude, architectural studies, doodles, pen and ink words, and pictures. Raw magazine. Maddening, fun, boring, exciting, page after page, Hot Potato by London, Ontario's cartoonist turned art world phenom is an assault on the eye, a challenge to the mind, and a joy to the senses. Part monograph, part comics anthology, Bell has delivered a sprawling magnum opus of his remarkably eclectic career to date. Like a too rich meal, Hot Potato is impossible to summarize without diminishing its achievement. Caspar by Diane Abomsuin, published by Drawn and Quarterly. At the start of this short, smart graphic novella, the first translated into English from the Montreal artist, illustrator, and NFB animator, Caspar Hauser informs us that he is going to tell us his story. Right away, the reader is faced with the possibility of multiple levels in this comics-based version of the life of the notorious 19th century German foundling, Caspar Hauser. My story implies the story of my life. It implies ownership. It implies a past tense. But how can Hauser be the narrator when he is dead at the end of the story? Who finishes the telling? And Hauser clearly does not own his life, as he doesn't know what it is or how it started. Hauser tells each incident in the present tense, so these events didn't happen in the past. Well, they happened in his past, as far as we readers are concerned, but to him they are always happening in the present. In short, Abomsuin is rocketing on all thrusters in her writing. If she's going to write another version of this popular tale, she's going to make sure we see it fresh. And the drawing, while simple, is also simply lovely and smart. It reminds you of the hand of a child, but the storytelling is very sophisticated. It's all about the pacing, the control. Abomsuin tells the story slowly and carefully, not pulling us along, but letting us drift along. The result is a small work of comic art that feels as rich and mysterious, if not more so, than comics twice its size. Red, A Hide a Manga, by Michael Nicole Yagulinas, published by Douglas and McIntyre. The original art that serves as the basis for Red is a 6 feet by 14 foot mural that explodes across the wall, huge, torrential, and exciting. Yagulinas' exhilarating book is a myth of the Haida told in the form of a manga that also bills itself as one of the world's largest comics. How cool is that? And now it exists in graphic novel form. Does it work to cut and paste art and reconfigure it in a book form? You bet, because Yagulinas starts his art with the comic panel, grows it to wall size, and then returns it to the comic book and loses nothing. Red is one of those wonderful mythic tales of warrior princes, lost loves, buffeting by loving and jealous gods, rites of passage, redemption of the tribe. But rather than one of those myths by a long-dead Greek or Roman, it's one from our own country. And the envelope, please.
The winner is George Sprott by Seth. Is Jack DeVere.
Good evening. It's an honor to be here. It really is. I also had a mother who collected my comics and threw them out. But I'm not here to talk about that. Later on, I would be happy to talk to anybody about that for a long time. I know I'm not, the jury deliberation is supposed to be a confidential process, but by way of kind of putting this award in context for you, there's a few things I'm going to rip the lid off of right now. One of the things was a comment that Seth's very good friend Chester Brown made to me during the course of the jury deliberations, which suggested that Seth might be embarrassed by winning this particular award. Being a modest individual, a serious artist, certainly not in it for prizes, and also conspiracy theorists take note, a prime instigator of these events. So I suggested to Chester that if Seth was going to be embarrassed by this kind of thing, that he might consider producing work that just sucks more. That would be the place to start. George Sprott, as I read it, and I read it in two forms. I read it as it was being published as a periodical comic in the New York Times Magazine, and then I read it as a stunning graphic novel. The interesting thing was that those are two fundamentally different reading experiences. They are satisfying reading experiences, and they say in no uncertain terms what an amazingly commanding graphic artist Seth is. But to read George Sprott as a book is to appreciate the creation of George Sprott, both the comic strip and the character, on a number of different levels, an appreciation that is only apparent within the medium of the graphic novel. George Sprott is at once a portrait of a character, of a country that is no longer with us in quite the same way. There are traces of that country, a country that I'm not even certain we should really mourn that it's gone, but it is no longer here. George Sprott was very much a creation of that country. It is a work about memory. It is a work about place. It is a work about culture. It is a work about the future, and it is a work about the past. But most importantly, as I say, it's a work which articulates all of these themes in terms of words and pictures and creates an evocative world, the world in which George Sprott lived, a monochromatic world, but I think most importantly, a world which represents the comic book art at its was also suggested over the course of the jury deliberations that this might not yet be Seth's best work. Now, this was said as a suggestion that perhaps we should step back and think about this. And we did step back long enough to think that if this isn't Seth's best work, then he better get to work very quickly, because we can't wait. And I hope he's ready to experience further embarrassment. I give you now the winner of the award for George Sprott, Seth.
Founders of the Doug Wright Awards. This always looks really terrible. And I recognize that. But I'd like to say, I don't always win when I have a book. When Wimbledon Green was up for the award a couple of years ago, I lost. And at the time, I took it with great noble and good-spiritedness. But the truth is, I was pissed off. But I really felt I should have won. And I had my speech and everything prepared. And I didn't win. But so this time, I just have some note cards. But so forgive me if this is a little disjointed, because I wasn't counting on it this time. But anyhow, obviously, I wanted to say a couple of thank yous to begin with. It goes without saying that I have to thank the New York Times. It was a great opportunity presented to me to work at the Times and to try something different, to work in a weekly format, which I'd never done before. And it also goes without saying that I have to thank Chronic Quarterly, that have supported me since the beginning of my career. Chris Oliveros says, you could not ask for a better publisher or friend. A gentle, kind person who supported my work and treated me with respect at all times. Even when I've gotten pissy about certain things, he's always been like understanding and, you know, waited for that calmer email to come in from me. I'd like to thank Peggy, whose connection to the company, since she's come to the company, has just been like a revelation. It's made the company a wonderful place to work. She's done such great work for me, promoting my books, shepherding me around, taking care of me, and running the company as well. Just, you know, I've been proud to be associated with her and Chris and Joining Quarterly. I have to, of course, thank Tom Devlin as well, because Tom did so much of the work of production on this book. And it was Tom who actually, after the strip appeared in the Times, said to me, like, you know, we should make this into a book. And the truth is, I wasn't really thinking that. I was thinking more along the lines of just cramming it into some Art of Seth book at some point. And it was Tom who suggested that and made me really sit down and rework the material and turn it into a book. And, of course, I want to thank my lovely wife, Tanya, who's always been very supportive and, you know, has, like all the wives of cartoonists, has endured the husband who lives in the basement 24 hours a day. And just as a side note, I'd like to thank Phyllis Wright, because Phyllis has been so wonderful in her support of the Wright Awards in general, and she's just been a joy to be connected to, and it's always so great to have her here. I've got a couple of things I just wanted to talk about, you know, since you got you here. You know, the comic industry has really changed since I came along. I mean, when I was a kid, I started reading comics like all kids. You know, I like superhero comics, and I read the, you know, stuff you bought at the newsstand. And, you know, when you're a kid and you decide to become a cartoonist, it's not like a decision you make as an adult for a career. It's like a childish pursuit. And I always say that, you know, you're basically, you get tricked into being a cartoonist, because you spend all those years as a child and as a teen, like, perfecting this craft, because you want to, like, draw Spider-Man or whatever. And by the time you're old enough to realize that you don't want to draw Spider-Man, there's nothing else you can do. So then you have to find something else to do with cartooning. And in the early 80s, that's when, you know, basically the world of alternative comics came along, and that really was a different time than now. In a lot of ways, it was kind of a grim scene. That world of comic shops and trying to sell your work through that that system was like a very different like experience than what's going on in comics right now. I mean, I can remember like tours around to those comic shops that were just, you know, so disheartening. As you'd sit at a table and a couple of people would pity you and come up to like get a book signed. I remember I was at a signing once in Albany, New York, where the comic shop owner actually called a friend of his to come. But you know, you felt like you were swimming upstream. You just weren't reaching the people that, you know, the work was aimed at. And it really made you doubt what the logic was of even like, you know, for trying to pursue this idea of telling adult stories in the comic book medium. It seemed kind of crazy at the time. I can remember, like, there just was no sense that, you know, this was, like, going to be an acceptable idea. It was, like, trying to tell, like, a serious story using matchbook covers or something. People just looked at it like it was a bad idea. I can remember talking to a girl once who was, that I was kind of pursuing, actually. And she was a color field painter, I remember, which I didn't really know what that was then, and I'm not so sure I know now. But I remember her looking at me and just saying, comic books cannot be art. It's just not possible.
And, you know, at that point, it really, you know, I didn't have anything much to back it up with. but things have changed. You know, the medium really has undergone, like, kind of a renaissance, I guess, in the last 10 years. And there is a feeling that, I think, out in the mainstream world now, that comics, they have been accepted as a serious medium. You know, it's still the early days of it. There's still, like, a great vista of work to be done. But I think that it's not considered an absurd idea any longer that you could tell serious stories, meaningful stories, through the medium of comics. I mean, I think comics are exciting because they might be the very last great visual medium that's in its infancy right now, narrative medium. And that makes it an exciting career to be part of. I feel thrilled that I'm still working in comics at this point. I remember in the late 90s, things looked grim. I can remember sitting with Chester Brown. I often tell this story. We're sitting in a coffee shop together, and we were saying, like, well, this looks like the end. It's like the comic shops were closing up, and we were starting to think, like, is Dronning Quarterly going to go out of business? And we thought, what are we going to do? You know, you're like, I guess it's back to the Xerox shop for us. But, you know, just within a year, that really turned around. I've never really been quite sure what happened around the year 2000. But somehow, the comics medium, like, it went from what looked like a certain doom to, like, a sudden flowering. And that's been very gratifying, to see comics come to be legitimized in some way. And so basically all this rambling is leading up to, I want to say something to the young cartoonists out there, the people who are starting out. I want to say this is a different medium you're working in now than when I started out. It was very underground at that point, and there was no restrictions placed on you, and you didn't have any feeling about it that you were trying to appeal to any kind of an audience. There was no audience to appeal to, and there was nothing publishers could offer you. They had no money, so why would you change anything you were doing? You just did what you did because that was the way it was. There was no compromise required in anything. But as the industry's been changing, I do have a sense now that there might actually be like a carrot out there you could reach for. And I think you have to be careful. You have to, like, hang on to that spirit that comics had in those days, which is the idea that, you know, you're doing this work for yourself. If the work isn't for yourself, what's the point of doing it? There's no point in producing comics that will be, that you will be thinking of the audience more than yourself. I really want you to remember that. Don't try to be comic book professionals. You're not professionals. Remember to be artists. Mm. That's the important thing. So thank you very much.
Brad, I'd like to call you up on stage one last time to round out the affairs.
Maybe
I should.
As well, I'd like to thank Phyllis, and I would be remiss not to mention, because I was chatting with her before about this, but in addition to the Collective Done Right, which I think is available back there, Dronning Quarterly is going to start publishing annual collections of the Nibber books with a kind of a brief introduction by me, designed by Seth, and I believe the first one debuts is 1962 to 1964. This August, so go buy one. I'd like to thank again all of our sponsors, and I think that's about it.